We're now beginning a study of the 42nd Psalm. The title of this psalm is interesting, and it's also rather difficult to make a full explanation of. The title says, "To the chief musician, Maskil, for the sons of Korah." Now we know we've had this phrase, "to the chief musician," many times before, and this simply means that the person in charge of the music for the congregation was to take this psalm and to use it in the most appropriate manner for the worship of the church. The word maskil means giving instruction. This title is prefixed to 11 psalms. And why such a title was prefixed to these psalms rather than to others is not known. So far as appears, the title in that sense would be applicable to many other psalms as well as to these, whether understood in this general statement of giving instruction or in general of giving instruction on any particular subject. It's not easy to give an account of the origin of such titles long after the occasion for placing the titles on the psalm has passed away. The phrase in this title, "for the sons of Korah," is rendered in the margin, "of the sons." The Hebrew may mean "for the sons of Korah," "of sons of Korah," or "to the sons of Korah." The psalms to which this title is prefixed are the 42nd, 44th, 45th, 46th, 47th, 48th, and 49th, and the 84th, 85th, 87th, and 88th. So far as the title is concerned, it may mean either that the psalms were dedicated to them, or that they were submitted to them for arranging the music, or that they were designed to be employed by them as leaders of the music, or that they were the authors of these psalms. That is, that the psalms thus indicated came from their body, that is, the body of the sons of Korah, or were composed by one of their number. Which one of these is the true idea must be determined, if it's going to be determined at all, from some other source than the mere title. The sons of Korah were a family of Levitical singers who descended from the Korah that we read of in the Old Testament. Korah was a great-grandson of Levi, according to Numbers 16, verse 1. He was united with Dathan and Abiram in opposition to Moses, and he was the leader of the conspiracy, as we read in Numbers 16, 2 and Jude 11. Korah had three sons, Aser, Elkanah, and Abiasap, according to Exodus 16, verse 24. And of their descendants, David selected a number to preside over the music of the sanctuary. We read this in 1 Chronicles 6, 22, 23, and 31. And they continued in this service under the time of Jehoshaphat, 2 Chronicles 20, verse 19. One of the most eminent of the descendants of Korah, who was employed especially in the musical service of the sanctuary, was Heman, 1 Chronicles 6, 33. All the sons of the Kohathites, Heman, a singer. The sons of Heman were appointed by David in connection with the sons of Asaph and of Jeduthun to preside over the music. This is in 1 Chronicles 15, 1, 4, 6, 2 Chronicles 5, 12, and also 29, 14, and 25, 15. The general term, the sons of Korah, seems to have been given to this company or class of singers. Their office was to preside over the music of the sanctuary, to arrange tunes for the music, to distribute the parts, and possibly to furnish compositions for that service. Whether, however, they actually composed any of the psalms is uncertain. It would seem that the usual custom was for the author of a psalm or hymn designed for public service to deliver it, after it was written, into the hands of these leaders of the music to be employed by them in the public devotions of the people. Thus, in 1 Chronicles 16:7, it is said, "Then on that day David delivered first this psalm to thank the Lord into the hands of Asaph and his brethren." Again, we read in 2 Chronicles 29, verse 30, "Moreover, Hezekiah the king and the princes commanded the Levites to sing praise unto the Lord with the words of David and of Asaph the seer. And they sang praises with gladness, and they bowed their heads and worshipped." So as we look at this title to the 42nd Psalm, we see then that it is not absolutely certain who composed this psalm. If it was written by David, which is certainly a possibility, it was with some reference to the sons of Korah, that is, to those who presided over the music of the sanctuary. In other words, it was prepared especially to be used by them in the sanctuary, in contradistinction from psalms which had a more general reference or which were composed for no such specific design. If it was written by the sons of Korah, that is, by any one of their number, it was intended by the author undoubtedly to illustrate the feelings of a man of God in deep trials. The language and the allusions were probably drawn from the history of David, since he furnished the best historical instance for such an illustration of this feeling. In this case, the language would be that of one placing himself, imagining himself to be in such circumstances, and giving in poetic form a description of the emotions which would pass through his mind as if they were his own feelings, unless it be supposed that one of the sons of Korah, the author of the psalm, had actually experienced such trials as this himself. It is most probable, though, that David was the author of this psalm, and that he composed it specifically for the use of the leaders of the music in the sanctuary. The occasion on which the psalm was composed by David, if he wrote it, or the occasion which was supposed by the author, if that author was one of the sons of Korah, is not certainly known. The psalm agrees best with the supposition that it was in the time of the rebellion of Absalom, when David was driven from his throne and from the place which he had appointed for the worship of God, after he had removed the ark to Mount Zion, and when he was an exile and a wanderer beyond the Jordan. This is found in 2 Samuel chapters 15 through chapters 18. The psalm records the feeling of one who had been driven away from the place where he had been accustomed to worship God, and his remembrances of those sad days when he tried to comfort himself in his despondent condition by looking to God and by dwelling on the promises of God. So beginning with the first verse of the 42nd psalm, "As the hart panteth after the water brooks, so panteth my soul after thee, O God." Now here's the picture of an animal that he calls a hart. This word, rendered hart, means commonly a stag, hart, or a male deer. The word is masculine, but in this place it is joined with a feminine verb, as words of the common gender may be, and thus it denotes a hind or a female deer. So as the hart panteth after the water brooks. To pant here means to be greatly desirous of, to have a great need for, to have an earnest need for. And it's simply saying that this animal is very thirsty. As this hart, as this female deer, panteth after the water brooks. The water brooks are the streams that flow in the mountain valleys. This animal was greatly in need of a drink of water. And the longer the need carried on, then the more desperate the animal became for satisfying its thirst. Some of those who have been to this area say that in that Syrian area where it was dry and arid, that great flocks of these deer would come to get a drink of water, and they would let a human come very close to them while they were in this desperate need for a drink, because their need for water was greater than their fear of humans. So that's the picture that's given here, this female deer, an animal that is very delicate, an animal that is very tremorous, and we can greatly associate pity and mercy and love with an animal of this nature. As this animal then would have a deep desire for a drink of water, it would pant after the water brooks. He says, "So panteth my soul after thee, O God." My soul has this same earnest need, this same earnest desire. My soul has this same thirst for thee, O God. Now this is the picture of one who has been forced to be separated from carrying out the worship to God as they have been accustomed to doing. Carrying out the worship to God as God would have him to do. And it would certainly fit very well with the time when David was forced to leave Jerusalem, when David was forced to go across the other side of the Jordan River. His son had Absalom had come in and deposed him from the throne, and so here David is in a very deep state of distress, and one of the greatest problems that he has is that he had been removed from the presence of the Ark of the Covenant. He had been removed from the place where the priests carried out their activities in the tabernacle, and so he placed himself in the same position as this female deer, as this hart, that would be desperately in need for a drink of water and would pant after the water brooks, even so, he says, so panteth my soul after thee, O God. It's a beautiful picture, but yet it's very descriptive of the circumstance that David was in at that time, and it should also be a reflection of our feelings anytime we may be deprived of the privilege of worshiping God. Now, it makes us wonder what kind of an attitude a person has who voluntarily would skip the prescribed worship of God. The worship that God intends for us to do, that He's commanded us to do. We have an example in the Bible of the church giving this kind of worship to God when we just elect not to do it. Do we have the same feeling that David had? Do we have the same feeling that God intends that His people have? Can we be saying at that time that, oh, I have such a thirst for God, I have such a longing for God, but yet we willingly miss assembling with other saints and worshiping God? So it gives us some very deep food for thought here as we see this picture that David paints of himself whenever he is in this desperate need to be with God. My soul panteth after thee, O God, just like that heart that panteth after the water brooks. Verse 2, he says, my soul thirsteth for God, for the living God. Now here he has a thirst for God, not just for God that might be some figment of man's imagination, or God that might be just in generality what we think of as a supreme being, but he says, I thirst for the living God. He knew his God. He knew what he had reference to when he talked about God. There's only one God. There's only one God that we recognize. There's only one living God. All other gods are pretenders and idols. And so that's what he was thirsting for here, for the living God. Not some private, self-manufactured God that we have as our own concept that we have come up with by meditation or by the traditions of the people, but we're talking about the true and living God, the one we read about in the Bible, the creator of the universe, the one who has the laws and the precepts for us to follow. So my soul thirsts for this God, he says. And we all know what it's like to have a need for a drink of water. We all know what it's like to be thirsty. And the longer we go without that drink, the longer we go in need of this water, the more intense it becomes. The more it becomes a pressing and desperate need for us to satisfy. It's not just that we would like to have a drink of water. It's not just that it would taste so good. But it also is that our body needs it. Our body is missing something that's very important, and survival can't continue very much longer without being able to have this drink of water. So those of us who truly love the Lord, those of us who are true followers of the living God, we have this this pressing need. We have this thirst for God anytime we may be separated from Him, anytime we may be deprived from carrying out the worship that God has prescribed for us to do. It's certainly not be a willing thing on our part that we do not do it. It's going to be something that we're forced into, and we have no way to control it. We have no way to overcome it. So he concludes verse 2 by saying, when shall I come and appear before God? When am I going to be able to again go back to that worship that I've known in the past? That worship that he wants me to do? That worship that I long for? It's not a matter of if I will do it. It's not a matter of maybe I'll do it. He knows he's going to do it if he has at all the strength and the ability. But it's a matter of when. When shall I come and appear before God? When am I going to be allowed to again have this great privilege of participating in the worship of God? And we sometimes may forget that it is truly a privilege that we are allowed to come together to worship God. That we're allowed to appear before God. These are great privileges that we have. And we should honor these privileges. We should recognize their value, and we should certainly not squander them. We should certainly not take them for granted, but we are most heavily privileged when we're allowed to come and appear before God. So we should have this same feeling that David has here anytime we may be deprived of assembling together to worship our God, as we're commanded to do in the New Testament. Verse 3 says, "My tears have been my meat day and night, while they continually say unto me, Where is thy God?" This is a further expression of the great distress that David was in upon this occasion when he was forced to be separated from the worship of God, the formal worship that was done there with the priest at the tabernacle. He says, "My tears." The word here for tears really means weeping. It's in the singular, actually. "But my tears," or "my weeping, have been my meat day and night." That has been my food. Rather than me eating, rather than me taking on sustenance from my body, I've been surviving on weeping. I've been living on tears. That's the most crowning event in my life at this time, is my distress, my mourning, my unhappiness at being separated from God. So my tears have been my meat day and night, while they continually say unto me. Now, these were his enemies talking to him. These were those that would taunt him, those that were wanting him to fall. While they continued saying to me, "Where is thy God?" It seemed as though you've been forsaken by God. You don't have a God. Your God is neglecting you. He's not coming to your rescue. He's allowing you to be put into this terrible state of distress. And so David expresses this. They're saying to me, "Where is thy God?" This is making my condition only worse. This is not allaying any of my fears or apprehensions, but it's designed to make me even more depressed, even more cast down in this terrible time. And certainly the same thing would happen to us. If we had some doubts and some fears, and then our enemies come along and heap more doubts upon that by asking these questions, "Where is thy God? Why have you been forsaken? Why aren't you being given relief from your distressful time?" Then this would even make our apprehensions that much greater. And this statement, "My tears have been my meat day and night," indicates that this was a continual thing with him. It wasn't just a part of the time he was having some grief about this, but day and night is an indication that this was continually his problem, his great desire to be with God. And it is so predominant that he, day and night, is living on tears. In verse 4 he says, "When I remember these things, I pour out my soul in me." Now, this verse is interpreted several ways. Some interpret this to be in the future tense, that he is going to yet do these things that he names in verse 4. But it's stated here in the King James and in several other translations in the past tense, as though as when he remembers what he had done in the past, then this makes him pour out his soul in me. That is, this is an expression of his grief. It causes him to have more grief as he remembers these things, and he names now what this is. "For I had gone with the multitude, I went with them to the house of God." He remembers that in times past, and those happier and more favorable times when he was allowed to go with the multitude, when he was allowed to go and worship God in this place called the house of God. This would have to be the tabernacle, of course. And he says, "With the voice of joy and praise, with a multitude that kept holy day." It was a time of joy. It was a time of praise. It was a time when he would lift his voice up to God. It was a time of worship, of adoration to the living God. He did it with others of like faith. He assembled together with those who believed like he did, and those who worshiped like he did, and those who had the same hopes and feelings and practices that he held. So he did it with a multitude that kept holy day. That is, it kept the day that was the day of worship. This could be the Sabbath day. It could be another a holy day, another day that prescribed by God for them to worship him. And as we see this applied to the life of David, to the life of the one who would live under the law, we see that the great principle also applies to us today in the church. As we remember these worships that we have participated in the times past to this true and living God, as we remember assembling together with the multitude, that is, with those who believe like we believe, with those who fellowship us and who we can fellowship, as we remember indulging and engaging in these acts of worship to God, when we would have the voice of joy and praise, whenever we would keep those ordinances that He's laid down for us to keep, whenever we would carry out the worship as prescribed for us by God and His Word, then to be deprived of that would make us pour out our soul as we remember doing it in times past, and remember those joyous times of worship, the times that we might be so apt to take for granted if we're not careful, then to be deprived of it is a time of grief. And to remember how we used to worship and now we can't do it anymore would make us pour out our soul then in ourselves. It'd make us in a very sad and despondent and distressed state. This also shows us that the time that's spent in worship to God, the time that's spent in assembling together with our fellow brothers and sisters in Christ, is very valuable time. It's time that's worthy of our remembrance. It's time that we, if we're deprived of it, will miss very, very greatly, as David did here. So not only must we participate in the worship of God, but we must place a very high value upon it as being among the very best of our endeavors. We're going to close our lesson at that point. Till next time, this is N.C. Crouch saying, goodbye, friends.